You hear people say this, I'm just not good at math. I'm not a math kind of person. And they'll tell you that sometime during trig, or maybe algebra, or maybe even long division, things just got too much for them. They said that was it. They put math down and they never picked it up again. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. My guest today is education analyst and author Sheila Tobias. If you have ever heard the phrase math anxiety, or perhaps science avoidance, you know something of her work. Sheila, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
If someone says, I'm just not good at math, is there truth in that? Are there people who aren't good at math?
Well, there may be one out of 150,000 or more who have something called dyscalculia. The fact that you haven't heard of it tells you how rare it is. And it's possible that a child has a perceptual difficulty that makes adding and subtracting hard to judge. If you reverse numbers and write 12 instead of 21, when you know that you've added up 21, it could be a problem. But normally, no. Normally, the reason people don't do well in mathematics has to do with a perception of themselves, an image of themselves, an elitism on the part of the math community that just discourages them personally from doing well. Nothing in the brain, nothing in the hormones, nothing in the genes.
So it's outside the person. Where does this come from, our perception that math is hard?
We think it's cultural. We think that there's a view that mathematics requires a certain kind of abstract thinking, that only a very few can do mathematics, that it is showing up early, if at all, and that you know by age 8 or 10 or 12, with the first bite of fractions, that you're probably not going to be good at math. But none of this is demonstrable. All we can measure really is performance. And so to assume that one has no ability really doesn't rest in fact. All we know is we're not performing under time pressure, on a test, we're not retrieving what we need when we need it. And so I raised a different question, and that was, assuming that we have the cognitive equipment in place to do mathematics, all of us who are readers and scholars and students, could there be something else that gets in the way of our retrieving the math we know when we need to know it? Could it be tension or stress or anxiety? And pursuing that line of reasoning, also without proof or evidence, because I could no more go into the brain than anybody else can, just pursuing that logically, I found that it's a way to remove from people's behavior the self-defeating behaviors that get in their way. And so that's what math anxiety really is about. It's a hypothesis that it's anxiety that is a failure of nerve, not a failure of intellect, that's getting in the way. And if that's the case, then one works on the anxiety. One removes the stress. One explores how one defeats oneself doing mathematics. And one goes on and does it.
Tell me why standing at the blackboard in fourth grade or sitting in a trig class or whatever point it might have hit someone, why does it turn to anxiety? The reason I'm asking this is, as you're talking, I'm thinking, all right, some people have trouble writing essays. Some people have trouble reading poetry or learning French, but I don't think I have a cultural awareness that it turns to anxiety in us.
Well, what you're asking is why does anxiety turn to a permanent irremediable block?
Oh, all right.
I think that's the question. We are all of us anxious at certain times.
Sure.
In fact, the psychologists talk about a facilitative anxiety, the kind that gets you up in the morning and gets you to work. It's very constructed. We also have a debilitative anxiety that turns us into vegetables. So I think the question is, why does one bad experience, going to the blackboard, failing a test, being embarrassed by raising your hand and giving the wrong answer, why does it become a permanent block? And that's an interesting question. We've done a lot of autobiographies of graduates of college, graduates of high school, asking them to walk back through their entire math life, so to speak, and remember positive and negative experiences and remember moments when their self-image changed. And what it appears to be is an expectation that there will come a point at which one will fail. And so when something occurs that triggers the stress, we think that's it. That's the end. The language people use to describe these events in their lives is they hit a wall. Or they fell off a cliff. Not the kind of language you use when you've had a momentary lapse. So we think that the culture defining math ability as there or not there gives us the impression that there's very little we can do about our math competence. We sort of have to wait passively until we discover whether or not we have it or we don't. And most of the people we interviewed who were severely math anxious said that they weren't even surprised when with fractions or algebra or even calculus it hit them. They'd half suspected that they'd been frauds all these years. They'd memorized. They hadn't really understood. Uh-huh. And so when they hit finally the idea or the concept they couldn't understand or deal with, they shut down, gave up, never went farther. And the whole task of people helping such math-anxious adults is to open that door, to return back to that moment, to help them understand it differently, to help them see that they were done to by a culture, a group of professionals who predicted that they wouldn't be mathematical, either because they were of minority background or of certain ethnic background or because they were female, and to go back and open that door. And once that door is opened, that's the good news, they can learn a great deal more and learn it well than
and
they
enjoy
ever thought
it.
They could and enjoy it.
You've mentioned several times culture. Is this a cultural thing? Are we Americans more prone to create people who are math anxious? And if so, why? What are we doing?
We don't know why, but we do know that if you ask a group of comparable adults, teachers, children, to explain why certain young people do better in math than certain other people in an Asian country, the answer will probably be that child is working harder. Mm. In our country, the answer will be that child has a gift for math or doesn't have a gift for math. So we do think it's peculiar to the American culture to posit math ability as a very special subset of intelligence.
A gene.
A gene or a hormone, that's right. And it's particularly costly to women because in the popular culture, women are less likely to have this so-called ability than men. And when a young girl has an interest in mathematics, it's discouraged and it even embarrasses her. We've interviewed some young women who said of their puberty period that they were embarrassed and made to worry about that part of their brain, as they put it, that was so mathematical. They worried that maybe it was a little masculine and maybe they should get rid of it. So this is all totally irrational, controllable, and our culture tolerates it far longer than it should.
We're talking today in Conversations with Sheila Tobias. She's the author of 5 books coming out of this subject. The first book was Overcoming Math Anxiety, which was published by the College Board in 1978 and is distributed by Macmillan. That book is undergoing a revision at this point and will be republished, brought out again by W.W. Norton in 1993, the fall thereof. This is Conversations. We're talking with Sheila Tobias about math anxiety and science avoidance, another topic coming up. I want to know I'm asking directly for your opinion. What do you think math anxiety among women or men who do not think they're inclined to math or minority people does to us as a nation? We're at a point now where people are saying we're sliding behind. Mm-hmm. We're not keeping up in terms of technology, mathematics, and the sciences with Japan or with Germany or other countries. Do you think it has an effect that our population
of course
is disabled?
Effect. The whole thing is linked to the elitist notion that only some people can do math and others can't. Take, for example, high school curricula. We turn math, higher mathematics, into an elective. We turn physics and chemistry into electives, but we require young people to study 4 years of English, 4 years of social studies, and even biology. What does that convey to the young people? That conveys that it is a special set of subjects for only a few who are destined, one might say, to go on and become practitioners. For the rest of us, it is out of bounds. And so it is not surprising to me that very few students go on through the college years and study science and mathematics. I'll give you a couple of numbers. We have 500,000 students enrolling in introductory physics and chemistry at American colleges and universities and two-year colleges. So they show a certain amount of interest and willingness to study these subjects. But at the end of that pipeline, at the PhD level, which is not for everybody but for some, and the nation certainly needs skilled scientists and mathematicians and engineers, there are about 10,000. So 490,000 young people have persuaded themselves or been persuaded that there's no place for them in science, mathematics, and engineering somewhere between freshman year and the advanced degrees. That comes, I believe, from the same principle that makes science and math electives in high school. Huh. Namely, it's not for everybody, it's only for the very few, and the cost to the country is very high. We're having to import our scientists and engineers, particularly at the advanced research level, from Russia, most recently, from the Far East, and Eastern Europe. And that may be very good for the individuals in those countries, but it closes down wonderful opportunities for very satisfying work to Americans, and it renders a whole second tier of American practitioners in law and banking in the Congress totally illiterate as regards science. Mm-hmm. All of this related to the notion that it takes a special kind of mind to do these subjects, different from the kind of mind it takes to master, say, American history. And until we root out that fundamental prejudice, I don't think we're going to solve these problems.
Loss to the individual?
Loss to the individual, substantial. There's a soft figure. I think you know what that means. We can't absolutely guarantee these numbers, but it looks as though for every additional year of math taken after ninth grade, you can count on $2,000 to $3,000 more annual income. So if you stick with math, say, through 4 years of high school, four times two or three, say $8,000 or $10,000 per year annual income. If you take a couple of years in college, add another $14,000 additional income, and so on. That shows you how these skills are valued in the economy. But that message is not directly passed on to students because the counter message that only a few can master these subjects intrudes. So that's our problem.
Let's go back to math anxiety. It interests me that you're presenting an emotional issue when talking about two art forms, math and the sciences, which are considered absolutely unemotional.
Yeah, that's very perceptive of you.
Well, this has to grate like sandpaper on the field.
Absolutely. The mathematicians and scientists in general expect us as learners to leave our emotions in the cloakroom,
sure,
so to speak, and bring in only that rational part of the brain, our gray matter, and possibly a little bit of the positive emotion of enjoyment or aesthetic pleasure in deriving a mathematics equation. But to present them with the assertion, and mine are assertions and arguments rather than proof, that some number of students really can't function intellectually because of the stress of learning mathematics in a stressful classroom or science, really causes them to rethink, if they're willing to, some of their assumptions about how you do math and how you don't. The way we work is to ask people to pay attention to their emotions, to try to capture them in mid-feeling, and we have them journal in class thoughts that occur to them that get in the way of their learning. Then we have them talk about that in a discussion session during or just after the math lesson, and find that over time they're able to exorcise these intrusions, these negative memories or these negative self-images. It's very important for people doing mathematics or science to trust their intuition. Not everything is immediately derivable through the rational part of the brain, but some of it is an intuition that is informed by experience. And that's the way true science works, and that's the way true mathematics works. But we discourage that in the classroom. We ask people to shut down their intuition, their feelings about the subject, and to proceed only as it's done in the book. And that by itself can be very inhibiting. So there are two levels of emotion we're gathering back into the math class. One is the personal feelings of competence or of positive or negative self-image. And the other is the hard-to-locate sense of a problem that gives you some intuitive feel for the problem. And we're trying to get the math and science people to recognize that they use these feelings in doing their work, and they should allow students, make room for students to bring those feelings to bear on their work as well. It would be a more truthful presentation of science and mathematics as it's currently done, and it would be decidedly less stressful for creative students who have many different ways of approaching problems. And that's the principle on which we work.
I can feel math teachers all over the nation tensing up. You're telling me how to teach. You're telling me my teaching is wrong. Yes? No?
Well, that's an inference one could draw. In essence, I'm really telling them what the learners are telling us. Uh-huh. And we've been interviewing learners and working with learners who turned off from mathematics years before, who are willing to come to a math clinic and talk about it, but who are saying, for anyone to hear, what I needed to learn in math class, I didn't learn. Now, it's not for me to tell the teacher how to teach it, but simply to mirror for the teacher this response. And if teaching is serious, and if the nation is serious about attracting more students to these subjects, we're going to have to pay attention to what they're telling us.
Okay. Sheila has been referring to we periodically. She works as a consultant to the Research Corporation, which is a corporation funded to research math and science, yes?
Well, to advance science.
To advance.
And they use a number of means to advance science, not least supporting scientific research.
Okay. And Research Corporation out of Arizona has funded a good deal of Sheila's research on math anxiety and later on the subjects of science avoidance, including, in terms of math anxiety, what she calls detox clinics, helping people to understand why they're anxious about mathematics and then work their way towards some sort of proficiency at one level or another of the subject. You talk about autonomous learning behavior. And this intrigues me on more levels than mathematics. Can you explain what that means and how one reaches it?
One of the ways I have done my research is through the interview process. I've interviewed people who are math anxious and people who have what I call math mental health, and also practitioners, people who are really skilled in and advanced in math and science. And what you notice as you go up the skills level and the confidence level is that the folks near the top are very much in charge of their learning. Oh, they go to class and they pay some attention to what the teacher says and they'll go back and do the assignment. But all the while they're making a lot of personal decisions about what's important, what isn't, how I learn, how can I make this material fit my learning style. They're in a take charge mode. And it appears to me, and again, I can't prove this because I haven't gone inside the brain and found locations for any of this, but it appears to me from their behavior that the most successful students are the ones who are active learners, who take charge of their own learning, are a little bit hard to control, you know, decide for themselves how they're going to make sense of this. So what we're talking about with autonomous learning behavior is setting up a classroom situation so that children are encouraged to take charge, to be more autonomous, to have autonomy, less passive, more in control of their learning, so that they will behave like some of the most successful students. Take the definition of math mental health. We define it as the willingness to learn the math you need when you need it. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to obediently learn math in all the steps as presented, but that you, as a functioning adult, are willing to take a class in accounting or take a class in stochastic processes or in probability as you need it. That means you are in control. You're like a client, and you're using your teachers, you're using your textbook as resources. It's a very different orientation toward learning a subject than what we are trained to do in school, which is to let the teacher decide in what order, in what sequence, how we are to perform.
And I sit at my desk and listen and take notes.
That's right, and that you're very passive. So in a way, it is a revolution in learning strategies and teaching strategies, but it isn't for me to tell the teacher how to do this, rather to ask the teacher to create an environment in which young people can learn how to teach themselves. In the end, that seems to be the definitive difference between the math-able and the math-disabled, not intellect necessarily, but capacity and ability to teach themselves. And so if we could teach our youngsters how to take charge of their learning and teach themselves, we would create not only greater confidence and greater competence as a result, but also lifetime learning. They could figure out a way to keep themselves in this mode.
If an adult or young adult is listening now and thinking, this is intriguing, I would like to do this, Is there a way for that person to begin training themselves to autonomous learning behavior?
Well, I think my books and the books written by other people are a good place to begin, because the first thing one has to believe is that one has a condition that is general. We find when we work with the math anxious, each of them will come and tell us, this is the worst case you've ever seen.
Right.
Don't expect to fix me. I heard you fixed my sister, my friend, my aunt, but not me. And we need to reassure people that their behaviors are a very common response to difficulty. So reading about it does help, whether it's my book or someone else's. Just reading in the library about math anxiety can be very reassuring. All of these books, including mine, walk you through a self-examination to get at the sources of your own anxiety, to walk you back through your personal history, and then allow you to play a little bit with some problems. And so for many math anxious adults or even teenagers, it may be the first math exposure they've had that's been a little fun, that's been at their level, that's invited them, you know, to come join us, come to the party, sit down at the table, you know, put your fork in the food, instead of being in a stressful teaching environment. Thirdly, then, one can go to the local university, the community college, and ask whether, even at a YWCA, whether there's a group of people who would collectively want to work together on their own personal math anxiety. And if they chipped in modestly, they could hire a graduate student in mathematics in the neighborhood and a counselor and put together their own. One doesn't have to wait for a math anxiety course to be presented. One can really construct one's own. The key is a group of like-minded and equally committed people, maybe of the same age and stage, because you don't want to be re-intimidated by people who went farther than you, a counselor who can work on the anxiety part, and a math instructor who can work on the math part. And for 6 weeks, 12 weeks, or 18 weeks, as long as it takes to get up to speed, I think one can benefit immensely by reviewing how one got to be as paralyzed as one is, and where one goes from here.
And a student who is in class, feeling herself, feeling himself falling behind?
That's a little more difficult, because there one isn't in control of the learning,
right?
It's a sequence that is being presented by the course of the teacher. But if I were a parent and had a child in this state, I would not let it fester. I would figure out a way to organize a math club, or even myself, however math anxious I am, to go back and review the material that the student is learning, the child is learning, to help them. Something has to be done immediately. It's as urgent as a virus, I would think, in a teenager, because it could make the difference between a career with a high trajectory and a career that is very disappointing.
You mentioned the parents. This is hard for some parents who are themselves, let's say, math anxious, or did at some point themselves just say, I don't do this.
Or who have bought into a cultural prejudice that a normal and soon to be popular young girl, young daughter, ought to be math incompetent as a sign of her femininity. So we have to root out these prejudices in teachers who are more attuned to the newer ideas about this than parents. And we have to do it right away.
If there was a parent in this situation who was sitting and listening and saying, my daughter Susie or my son Bob is just turning away from mathematics, do you challenge that parent to do anything in particular?
Absolutely. The parent has to take seriously this as a temporary disability and work on it very seriously.
We're talking with Sheila Tobias today on Conversations. Let me tell you a little bit about some of her other books. Again, Overcoming Math Anxiety, first published in 1978 and then a second edition in 1980. Once again, it's coming out in the fall of 1993, revised and published by W.W. Norton. Her second book was Succeed with Math. So here, Ms. Tobias was moving from the problem to steps towards a solution. Succeed with Math, subtitled Every Student's Guide to Conquering Math Anxiety. Macmillan distributed the book, still distributes it. It is published in 1987. Then, They're Not Dumb, They're Different. Stalking the Second Tier came out in 1990, published by one of the foundations that supports Sheila's work, the Research Corporation, and two others, Breaking the Science Barrier and Revitalizing Undergraduate Science, came out in 1992, both of them. A couple of other books upcoming by Sheila Tobias. What's the second tier? What is that?
The second tier is a group of students I define as intellectually able, they're majoring in English, they're majoring in French, they're majoring in, they're going to go to law school, who are convinced and whose teachers are convinced that they can't do college-level science. And as a way to dispel that mythology, I employed, paying them, a group of graduate students in all these fields other than science who had never taken college-level science but who did not have mathophobia. It was important to sort those out. And I asked them to enroll in full semester-long courses in physics and chemistry. And the reason I chose physics and chemistry is that these are perceived to be the more difficult of the sciences. I could have chosen biology, but I did not. They had two tasks. One was to do as well as they could in these courses, along with the undergraduates, put in all the time necessary and do the homework and take the exams, because I wanted to prove to the science community that there's a whole lot of people out there who could do science and are choosing not to. And their second task was to keep a detailed record of everything they noticed about these courses, the features of the delivery system, how they were presented, the attitudes and behaviors of their fellow students, and most of all, how it felt to them to be grappling with some of these concepts in introductory physics and chemistry. And I knew that the faculty would find very interesting their response because they are highly verbal, good writers, and good observers. The participant observation model, which is what they used, is a very interesting one. You participate in something, and then essentially you interview yourself at the end of the week, and you write a record of everything you noticed and everything you thought about during the week as regards this experience. The results were very noticeable. First, that they did outstandingly well. Of the group, only one had trouble, real trouble, in passing the class, and she was a survivor, so she put together a study group and got herself through, but without making a great record. The others did outstandingly well, some of them the best in the class, which was quite confusing for the scientists who believed that their system of sorting people out works. And here they'd missed all these people and had let them go. But their comments were very revealing and deeply critical of how science, to summarize briefly, is made more difficult even than it has to be. And that's what I wrote about, and that's what has been widely read by the science community and is beginning to have an impact on college-level science.
This is Sheila Tobias. Our subjects, math anxiety and science avoidance on Conversations. Science is made more difficult than it should be.
Than it has to be.
Than it has to be.
Well, it's a matter of a tradition of teaching it in little bits and pieces so that the entire picture is reserved for the third year in the row and for a student who doesn't go on. The bits and pieces remain unconnected.
No framework to hang.
No framework on which to hang the ideas. A far too much emphasis on skills building and technique, which is unsatisfactory. Much too much competition in the classroom for grades. Grading on a curve sets one student opposed to another student and makes it difficult to form any kind of community or discussion within the class. Far too much covered for the amount of time. Everybody says it, but nobody does anything about it. The textbooks have doubled in size in the last 30 years. Mm. The amount of time spent is about the same. The pace, therefore, and the coverage, far too much. And above all, and perhaps this is what has been most observed as interesting by the science community, a situation where the professor owns the material, and the student, again, is in this passive situation, having to take it from the professor's mouth, not able to discover the material for himself. And if you remember what we talked about as regards math anxiety, the autonomous learning behavior, the taking charge of one's own learning, the setting oneself in a relationship with the subject and exploring it in a kind of slow way, at one's own pace, by means of one's own style of learning, all that is precluded in a classroom where it's like moving a freight train. Freight train has to keep moving because chapter one has to be covered, and then chapter three, and then chapter seven, and then chapter eight. And all of this renders, say, my outstanding learners, I call them expert learners because they're very good students, they're just new to the field, all of this renders the science taught in college and probably in high school as well more difficult than it has to be. And that's the message I've been trying to extend to the science faculty.
What happens between grammar school and, let's say, middle school, where it seems like science is fun? Kids do experiments together, they do projects, they watch how things grow, they watch the effect of one thing on another. And it feels like science is then offered as something which engages the student. What happens by the time you get to late high school or college science that makes this no longer engaging? Why the shift? Is it because it becomes, quote, serious?
I can't really answer that. There are several things that change. One is the pace and the coverage. It gets more serious.
Serious.
A second is it gets much more quantitative. And a third is more abstract. You're looking now at molecular reactions, at molecules that you can't see. You're looking at physical situations that are extrapolated from reality. So it becomes a matter of imagining a circumstance that doesn't really exist. And that makes it much more difficult for learners.
So it is more difficult?
I think so.
All right. So that's real. Don't scientists say to you, Sheila, learning the way I'm learning, learning the way I learned, worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
Why should I coddle these students who can't keep up?
Well, that's a problem we have in dealing with any kind of reform, that the people who are masters of the subject succeeded in a system that we're now asking them to change. And clearly, it's going to be very difficult for them to consider changing a system that worked for them. So what we have to do is persuade them that the loss to the field or the loss to the country is sufficient to compensate for the stress and the discomfort that they are going to have moving into another system. What's happened in science and mathematics more than in other subjects is that there's been a seeking in the class for younger versions of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have is a narrowing of a pipeline where certain kinds of students with certain attitudes toward science are encouraged and others are discouraged. What we have to persuade them is that of all those people out there, some large number could do science, could even make a contribution, but in a fashion that is different from the mainstream. And that was the purpose of They're Not Dumb, They're Different, this
yes.
book, Stalking the Second Tier, that we would find students that the science community would have considered most unlikely to participate in science, demonstrate how good they are, how good they could be, and sort of rattle the cage. That was the purpose, rattle the cage. My strategy went something like this. There was a character you meet in the first chapter named Eric. Eric is a graduate in English literature, and Eric is taking physics for the first time. And Eric is finding much fault with introductory physics, but he is also awfully good, and his comments are very profound. And I was hoping that the reader would meet Eric in chapter one and say, wow, it would be fun to teach Eric. Wouldn't it be nice to have him in class? And then by chapter eight, when he's met Eric and Stephanie and Laura and, you know, many, many more of the same ilk, begin to wonder whether the way the class is structured, it's impossible for him to identify Eric. In other words, there may well be an Eric and a Stephanie and a Laura and a Jackie in the class, but this class is so large and the pace is so fast and the interaction is so meager that there's no way this professor is going to locate Eric. And at that point, and this was my strategy, that professor might begin to think critically about the style of teaching that has become so traditional in college-level science and might begin to examine the assumptions and change the way he teaches. And it has begun to happen.
That's what I was going to ask. Are there the instances of professors or of whole institutions saying, we want to attract a
yes.
wider field?
Yeah, and on my second book for the Research Corporation called Revitalizing Undergraduate Science, I looked at 11 case studies where change is really underway and tried to extend the reach of that change by telling people about it. So there's no question that it is underway, but it will take a very long time. Remember, 500,000 students are in introductory physics and chemistry courses. Until all of those courses are changed, it will be a while.
I'm anticipating objections as you're talking, just to try and see the other side. We all watch institutions, whether we're looking at elementary school or graduate school, under the gun economically. Their budgets are shrinking. They've got problems raising funds for coming years. And we're also seeing that class size is growing. So I perceive the teachers, whether they are elementary teachers teaching a whole range of subjects or teachers teaching graduate students, are feeling great stress just to impart knowledge that must be imparted in a semester's time to their allotment of students and prepare for the next job. aren't we dealing with people who are a little overwhelmed?
It could be, and what I ask faculty to think about when they think about making improvement is to sort things out in three columns. One is what we can control, and it seems to me under that column is tomorrow's class. I can move into class tomorrow and say, class, I was going to give you a lecture with very little opportunity for you to interact, and I've changed my mind. I'm going to write five questions on the board, and we're going to use those as the basis of discussion. And I'm going to do that for 2 weeks instead of formally lecturing. And then I'm going to assess and ask you to help me assess whether you've been learning the material more deeply. That doesn't cost any money. That doesn't require a shrinking of the class. It is simply a way of changing the style in midstream of what one does. Or, as I will talk about here, the subject of testing. One can alter the tests in such a way that a different kind of learner with a different learning style will succeed in introductory science or mathematics better than he or she would have before. The second column would be things that are hard to control, harder to control. They're going to take lobbying the legislature or lobbying the dean or changing behavior or changing attitudes. And those are not to be overlooked, but they can be done, you know, the day after tomorrow. And the third column would be things that are doable in the immediate short run. I call it what we can do tomorrow or what we can do today. And it seems to me that a lot of reformers who are well-intentioned have given up, have thrown up their hands because they try to take on everything at once. And recognizing what you pointed out, that these are shrinking budgets and we have to be very cost-effective, it's not possible to do all at once. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do something. And the one thing we can do is change our teaching behavior, our student expectations in the classroom as soon as we can. Students will respond, some of them negatively, because we're changing the rules on them too fast. But in time, students will get used to the fact the teacher really wants me to talk. Teacher really wants me to think out loud. Teacher really wants me to speculate. I won't be punished for coming up with a different way of achieving the answer. And in time, there will be real changes in a willingness to learn these subjects.
How did you get involved with this work?
Oh, it's a feminist orientation on my part. I would ask, as a good feminist must, of any career or field, why are there fewer women than men? And if you ask that question of the unenlightened, the answer will be, oh, women aren't as smart as men in, or women aren't as willing as men to, or women don't really want or don't really need. And if you don't believe that women are all that different from men, you have to ask the question a different way. That if women are more similar to men than is generally conceded, why then are women under-enrolled in mathematics or science? What is it about the subject, not about women, what's it about the subject or the way it's taught, that's turning them away? And that raises a lot of questions which follow logically from that position. Mm-hmm. But so long as you believe men and women to be intellectually different, these anomalies won't strike you. It won't strike you as odd that some 2 or 4% of the physicists working today are female, or that until recently fewer than 15% of the engineers were female. It won't strike you as odd unless you start with the premise that women are equal and almost interchangeable with men. Then these things will seem odd, and that makes you ask questions.
This is Sheila Tobias on Conversations. She was educated at Radcliffe and at Columbia Universities. Her bachelor's was in history and in literature from Radcliffe. She took a master's in European history and then a master's of philosophy, both from Columbia. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. I'll mention also that Ms. Tobias has held a number of teaching positions and administrative posts in addition to her research and writing. She's been a visiting professor at the University of California at Davis since 1984. Is that still ongoing?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, since 1984. Among other courses, she teaches political science, gender and politics, and feminist theater at UC Davis. Also at the University of Southern California, at Vanderbilt, at City College of New York. And she has held administrative posts at Cornell and at Wesleyan University. At Cornell, she was the assistant to the vice president for academic affairs and associate provost for 8 years at Wesleyan University. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. This is too large a question, and so I'll just ask it and you can answer what part you want. As a feminist who has watched this nation both generally and through the specific glass of your research over the last 20 years, Are we in a place of progress, decline, or stasis?
Oh, it's a good question. I'm writing a book now called Gender and Politics, The Legacy of the New Feminism in America, which traces our roots back to the 19th century, but isn't really a history of the 19th century, rather a look at the politics of the first movement in comparison to the politics of the second. And I must say, all of us used to think our foremothers were just lying around doing nothing, because we wondered why it took 75 years to go from the assertion of the right of women to vote to the achievement of the right of women to vote. It's a period of about 1848, 1850 to 1920. Mm. But having lived through the first 20 years of this second wave of feminism, as it's sometimes called, I can attest to the fact that things do take a lot longer. I see it in phases, and I would like to offer this theory in any case, which I'm researching now in the book. And that is that in the first phase of assertion of women's equality, barriers fell rather rapidly. And that is because America is truly committed, at least at the theoretical level, to equal opportunity for all. And once it was pointed out to the average American that females were discriminated against at the level of employment or at the right to go to a bank and get a credit loan to buy a house just because they were female or just because they were married, or that pregnancy wasn't covered under ordinary health care, it really stuck in the craw of the typical American. This was really unfair. This is an unlevel playing field. Why should women not be able to compete for Rhodes scholarships or for financial aid in colleges? Why should some of the best colleges be closed to women altogether? And so on. And so I think that from year 67 or so, when the feminist movement began to emerge in its second phase, until 1978 even, 75 to 78, for about 10 years, there was a rapid increase in achievement. I mean, the laws were passed, barriers fell. The entire now Bill of Rights, which now came up with as a set of 10 goals in 1968, was virtually in hand by 1978. Everything had happened. And then there was a shift, what looked like a backlash, and I've studied that as well with Phyllis Schlafly and others, turning a large percent of the country, not the majority, but a large minority, opposed to women's rights or women's independence, women's autonomy. And one can explain that in cycle terms. One could say, well, the cycle goes in one direction, then it goes in another. I explain it differently. I think that we entered a second phase of legislative and other goals, which went beyond equality for women into an area that is much more controversial, namely the assertion and the desire to set things up so that women would be interchangeable with men. That is, that anything men could do, women could do. That's when combat issues loom. That's when the issue of women's sports looms. That's when abortion becomes ever more controversial, not only because some people feel very strongly, and they have a right to, that this is the killing of a fetus, but also because easy access to abortion, easy access to birth control, gives women total control over their bodies and therewith total control over their lives. And that was something a lot of people didn't want to see happen. So in phase two, we had much more controversial claims and legislation, and it was during that phase that the Equal Rights Amendment was defeated, and a lot of hostility to women's issues emerged that have been documented by Susan Faludi and others. I would like to think that we're now moving through that into a new phase. We have a president, an administration that's very favorable toward women's issues, a president and his own wife, I think, who exhibit interchangeability of emotional roles. He's president, she's not. But in terms of his behavior, he's more the feminine male, and yes, she the more, quote, masculine female. And so we're going to see modeling of alternative behaviors in the next 4 years and longer that will perhaps release us from some of the stereotypes that we brought with us. The reason my analysis, I think, is solid is that if you look at other countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, that from the top down legislated equality for women, you find that they too postponed what we call the sex role debate, the debate as to what's appropriately male, what's appropriately female. And therefore, in periods of stress, they reverted. And a lot of women lost a lot of their powers. Or as we've heard about the Soviet system, women had two jobs. They went to their careers, and then they had to do all the household work. So I think that we are in a natural state, and I now understand better our foremothers. It may take 75 years to achieve everything that's on a feminist agenda, but I think the slope of the curve is in the right direction. I do not think there's backsliding. I think with every passing decade, a group of people who resist these changes is disappearing from the positions of power, and young people coming up who may take it too much for granted, and we have to worry about that, still are so used to certain rights and privileges, these young women, that there is no way, and there will never be a way to take them back.
So time is a factor. We are moving through an older generation holding what you think of as older.
Time is one factor, and absence of crisis is another factor. I would not want to predict, I would not want to watch what happens if, say, the American economy were to undergo the kind of downturn that we had in the Depression 30s. That cost women a lot of privilege. The 30s saw women who were teachers, who were credentialed, losing their jobs because the nation felt it was unfair, unjust for two people in one family to bring home paychecks when people were suffering. So if we have a more or less economic prosperity, perhaps less or more, but at least a certain amount of economic security for all, if we are not in a war situations are not good for women. Mm-hmm. That's when machistic skills and power loom larger. And if we don't have any kind of reversal at the top, as we almost did during the Reagan-Bush years, I think that progress will be steady. But there will always be stressful times as we cut off, like an icebreaker, the next set of prejudices or expectations.
Do you perceive this as a national discussion that goes on different fronts with different kinds of subject matter? That is to say, we discuss the position of American women through the issue of abortion, or the position of American women through the issue of women in combat, and that overarching over that all as an umbrella is the discussion of where women in the American society, and not too parenthetically, then the discussion of where men in
That's
American
right.
society.
I was going to actually correct your phrase and say I think the discussion of sex roles is very ubiquitous in our society today. It has to do with the issue of gays in the military, mm-hmm. and all sorts of roles are coming into question. And that is precisely where and when feminist claims become controversial. So long as the feminist movement was or is arguing for equal opportunity, it's a less threatening set of legislative goals than when it begins to raise the whole question of appropriate sex roles. And we can't turn back. Sex roles were the natural next issue after equal opportunity, because there will be no equal opportunity so long as people are locked into their roles. Mm. But I think this country, more than any other, is probably going to see, to witness the truer opportunities for women than anywhere else because of this deep, long-lasting discussion. It is impossible to clip articles for a book on the issue of women in American society. One would have to clip entire newspapers. And any one day, there are 10 articles or 10 issues being explored, either by the press or by people, as reported by the press, that bear on the issue of sex roles. Mm.
This is Sheila Tobias, my guest today on Conversations. The new book, upcoming in 1994, it's still being written, is called Gender and Politics, The Legacy of the New Feminism in America. It'll be published by W.W. Norton in 1994. Sheila's work in science avoidance and math anxiety has been supported by such foundations as the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, the Lilly Endowment, the Fund for the Improvement of the Post-Secondary Education, and, as mentioned before, Research Corporation for the Advancement of Science. She has won a number of awards for her work and for her academic achievements in past and in present. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. When you and I have talked before, you have talked about what you call the density wave in academia. Can you describe that, but look at it more generally? Is there a density wave in American life, not just
For women, you mean?
Yes.
Of course there is. One goes back historically.
People will not know what it is. So
okay, let me explain what it is. There's a group, there's a generation, really. Density wave is just a fancy physics way of describing a generation of women who came of age somewhere around 1970, started college, took themselves more seriously than their older sisters because of the activism of feminism and because of its media attention, and moved through their 20s and now their 30s and now their 40s into positions of high achievement career-wise and power. We saw this as President Clinton started to look for women to populate his administration. There wasn't just the one token female, as there was in Roosevelt's day. It was one cabinet officer, an outstanding woman, but only one. Instead, there were layers of women he could draw on, women the American public hadn't heard of, but who were well known in centers of government. What happened in the 1940s and 30s is that because of the Depression and later World War II, women who might have made a mark in their various careers were erased from their opportunity. And in the feminine mystique period, this was underscored even more. It became even more difficult for college-educated women to promote themselves as independent scholars, as I am, or activists, or members of historically high-ranking professions. And so in each generation, there's a 15-year group of over 15 years who set a tone and become mentors for younger women and will move men, too, by their numbers. And the generation preceding mine, a group of women who would today be about 70, was simply absent. Mm. And so the effect of a missing generation was to discourage the next generation of women coming up. But my generation was activist and present in small numbers, and we were able to generate, literally, the next generation of women who were active and committed, high in self-confidence, and in greater numbers. And it's that generation now making its way through the power structure that I think has in its hands the transformation of America. Hillary Clinton is in that generation. Hillary Clinton was in law school when I was a provost of a university. She benefited indirectly, I like to think even directly, because she was in a law school about 20 miles away from where I was a provost, but she certainly benefited indirectly from the activism of women of my generation. Opened doors for her, made it possible for her to get opportunities to work in certain law firms, work for certain judges, to be admired for her work. And when she moved to Arkansas as an independent lawyer and maintained her contacts with the Children's Defense Fund, mm-hmm. she was working with and for a number of women of her generation and a little older who would not have been available to women of my generation. So there's what the mathematicians would call really a geometric or exponential increase in the numbers and in the confidence level of women as a group older than they opened the door for the group younger than they. And this group of women, represented by Clinton and his wife, who are now in their early 40s, will cause major institutional changes and accommodations that women of my generation, smaller in number than we were not able to, which will make it even easier for the next generation to move forward. That's why the risks, the fears, what we have to worry about is not so much how Americans feel about this revolution. This revolution is here, and it's here to stay. It's rather such meta forces as the nature of the economy altogether, the degree of national security that we can enjoy so that we don't have to be sending troops out to war, and the general health and welfare of the country. If those things can be maintained at a reasonable level of satisfaction for the majority of Americans so that they don't resent this group of women coming forth, I think we will never again be the society in which I grew up.
Do you worry then do you worry less then about what is called the complacency of the younger generation of women?
I do worry less than a lot of feminists do. And the reason for that is an analysis that I borrow from Gloria Steinem, who's a great teacher and mentor. Gloria Steinem wrote an article once called, "Why Are Young Women More Conservative Than Older Women?" And she answered it in her fashion by saying there were several experiences that radicalize women politically that young women can't yet have had. One of them is growing old. One of them is getting married and getting divorced. Another is going out in the job market and being treated perhaps unequally. And all of those experiences really occur after college. between 25 and 35. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that the typical joiner of a feminist organization will be a woman who has finished with some of the business of being a woman. She may have children, may be married or not married, but she's already about 30 and has thought more deeply about life and about fairness and is a mother of daughters and is thinking about her daughter's future. In the very beginning, and we didn't always publicize this because it was comfortable to have the media believe that thousands of women students were in our camp. But in fact, in yes. point of fact, the feminist movement on campus was populated by women over 30. Mm-hmm. Always was, may always be. Younger women are still influenced by fantasy. There will be not just a Mr. Right on the horse to marry them, but a Mr. Right in the office to hire them. And it is not for us to disabuse them of those fantasies. I mean, part of the business of being a mentor to younger women is to nurture them, try to make them a little more realistic, but not read them too much of the disturbing information. So we let them discover that for themselves, hope that they are trained well enough and secure enough and confident enough to cope with the disappointments, and expect them to become politically active later.
You're quite optimistic. Is mm-hmm. the glass ceiling growing thinner?
I'm sure it is. Yeah. I'm sure it is. One of the problems women of my generation had is that we never worked for women. I mean, there was never a woman in my life but one who even sat on a decision-making board to fund my work. That's because the people a generation older were all males. Inevitably, women in power are going to be fairer in terms of hiring and promoting women. They will be able to identify with a woman who has mothering responsibilities as no man has been able to. So as women move into power, I think we will see more women breaking the glass ceiling. The glass ceiling, from my perspective, is just a phenomenon related to the density wave. As the density wave mm-hmm. has moved on through, people are noticing that there are lots of associate professors or lots of junior law partners, but fewer at the top. And so they're calling it a glass ceiling. I'm simply calling it a time lag.
We're paying attention to something that was always there because we're high enough to see it.
That's right.
I see. This is Conversations. We've spent an hour with Sheila Tobias, and thank you. It's been a very interesting hour. Before we leave, here is the list. A pencil, if you like. Sheila Tobias's books, coming out in 1994, Gender and Politics, The Legacy of the New Feminism in America. Look for it under a W.W. Norton title. Overcoming Math Anxiety will be revised and republished by W.W. Norton in the fall of 93. Look for it there. Past books, all on the shelves or in the bookstores. Revitalizing Undergraduate Science by Research Corporation, 1992. Breaking the Science Barrier, a book written with husband and physicist Carl T. Tomazuka, published in 1992 by College Board and distributed by Macmillan Books. They're Not Dumb, They're Different, Stalking the Second Tier is also on your shelves. Succeed with Math, Every Student's Guide to Conquering Math Anxiety, and the book that started it all, Overcoming Math Anxiety, books by Sheila Tobias. Sheila, thanks again. I hope you'll join me again next week.